Chesed. Chapter 23. The analogy of opposites is the relation of light to shadow, peak to abyss, fullness to void. Allegory, mother of all dogmas, is the replacement of the seal by the hallmark, of reality by shadow. It is the falsehood of truth, and the truth of falsehood. Eliphas Lévi, Dogme de la Haute Magie, Paris, Balliere, 1856, Roman 22, 22. I went to Brazil out of love for Amparo. I stayed out of love for the country. I never did understand how it was that Amparo, a descendant of Dutch settlers in Recife who intermarried with Indians and Sudanese blacks, with her Jamaican face and Parisian culture, had wound up with a Spanish name. For that matter, I never managed to figure out Brazilian names. They defy all onomastic dictionaries and exist only in Brazil. Amparo told me that in their hemisphere, when water drains down a sink, the little eddy swirls counterclockwise, whereas at home ours swirls clockwise. Or maybe it's the other way around. I've never succeeded in checking the truth of it. Not only because nobody in our hemisphere has ever looked to see which way the water swirls, but also because, after various experiments in Brazil, I realized it's very hard to tell. The suction is too quick to be studied, and its direction probably depends partly on the force and angle of the jet and the shape of the sink or the tub. Besides, if this is true, what happens at the equator? Maybe the water drains straight down, with no swirling, or maybe it doesn't drain at all. At that time, I didn't agonize over the problem, but Saturday night in the periscope, I was thinking how everything depended on telluric currents, and the pendulum contained the secret. Amparo was steadfast in her faith. "The particular empirical event doesn't matter," she said. "It's an ideal principle which can be verified only under ideal conditions, which means never, but it's still true." In Milan, Amparo's disenchantment had been one of her most desirable traits. But in Brazil, reacting to the chemistry of her native land, she became elusive, a visionary capable of subterranean rationality. Stirred by ancient passions, she was careful to keep them in check, but the asceticism which made her reject their seduction was not convincing. I measured her splendid contradictions when I watched her argue with her comrades. The meetings were held in shabby houses decorated with a few posters and a lot of folk art, portraits of Lenin and Amerindian fetishes, or terracotta figures glorifying the cangaceros, outlaws of the Northeast. I hadn't arrived during one of the country's most lucid moments politically, and after my experiences at home, I decided to steer clear of ideologies, especially in a place where I didn't understand them. The way Amparo's comrades talked made me even more uncertain, but they also roused a new curiosity in me. They were, naturally, all Marxists, and at first they seemed to talk more or less like European Marxists, but the subject somehow was always different. In the middle of an argument about the class struggle, they would suddenly mention Brazilian cannibalism, or the revolutionary role of Afro-Brazilian religions. Hearing them talk about these cults convinced me that at least ideological suction down there swirled in the opposite direction. They described a panorama of internal migrations back and forth, the disinherited of the North moving down toward the industrial South, where they became sub-proletarians in immense, smog-choked metropolises, eventually returning in desperation to the North, only to repeat their flight southward in the next cycle. But many ran aground in the big cities during these oscillations, and they were absorbed by a plethora of indigenous churches. They worshipped spirits, evoked African divinities. And here Amparo's comrades were divided. Some considered this a return to their roots, a way of opposing the white world. Others thought these cults were the opiate with which the ruling class held an immense revolutionary potential in check. And still others maintained that the cults were a melting pot in which whites, Indians, and blacks could be blended. For what purpose, they were not clear. Amparo had made up her mind. Religion was always the opiate of the people, and pseudo-tribal cults were even worse. But when I held her by the waist in the Escolas de Samba, joining in the snaking lines to the unbearable rhythm of the drums, I realized that she clung to that world with the muscles of her belly, her heart, her head, her nostrils. Afterward, she was the first to offer a bitter, sarcastic analysis of the orgiastic character of people's religious devotion, week after week and month after month, to the rite of carnival. Exactly the same sort of tribal witchcraft, she would say with revolutionary contempt, as the soccer rituals in which the disinherited expended their combative energy and sense of revolt, practicing spells and enchantments to win from the gods of every possible world the death of the opposing halfback, completely unaware of the establishment which wanted to keep them in a state of ecstatic enthusiasm, condemned to unreality. In time I lost any sense of contradiction, just as I gradually abandoned any attempt to distinguish the different races in that land of age-old, unbridled hybridization. I gave up trying to establish where progress lay, or where revolution, or to see the plot, as Amparo's comrades expressed it, of capitalism. How could I continue to think like a European once I learned that the hopes of the far left were kept alive by a Nordeste bishop suspected of having harbored Nazi sympathies in his youth, but who now faithfully and fearlessly held high the torch of revolt, upsetting the wary Vatican and the barracudas of Wall Street, and joyfully inflaming the atheism of the proletarian mystics won over by the tender yet menacing banner of a beautiful lady who, pierced by seven sorrows, gazed down on the sufferings of her people. One morning Amparo and I were driving along the coast after having attended a seminar on the class structure of the lumpenproletariat. I saw some votive offerings on the beach, little candles, white garlands. Amparo told me they were offerings to Yemanja, goddess of the waters. We stopped, and she got out and walked demurely onto the sand, stood a few moments in silence. I asked her if she believed in this. She retorted angrily, "How could I think of such a thing?" Then she added, "My grandmother used to bring me to the beach here, and she would pray to the goddess to make me grow up beautiful and good and happy." Who is that Italian philosopher who made that comment about black cats and coral horns? "It's not true, but I believe in it." Well, I don't believe in it, but it's true. That was the day I decided to save some money to venture a trip to Bahia. It was also the day I began to let myself be lulled by feelings of resemblance, the notion that everything might be mysteriously related to everything else. Later, when I returned to Europe, I converted this metaphysics into mechanics, and thus fell into the trap in which I now lie. But back then I was living in a twilight that blurred all distinctions. Like a racist, I believed that a strong man could regard the faiths of others as an opportunity for harmless daydreaming, and no more. I learned some rhythms, ways of letting go with body and mind. Recalling them the other evenings in the periscope, to fight off growing numbness, I moved my limbs as if I were once again striking the agogu. "You see," I said to myself, "to escape the power of the unknown, to prove to yourself that you don't believe in it, you accept its spells. Like an avowed atheist who sees the devil at night, you reason, 'He certainly doesn't exist. This is therefore an illusion, perhaps a result of indigestion.' But the devil is sure that he exists and believes in his upside-down theology. What, then, will frighten him? You make the sign of the cross, and he vanishes in a puff of brimstone." What happened to me was like what might happen to a pedantic ethnologist who has spent years studying cannibalism. He challenges the smugness of the whites by assuring everybody that actually human flesh is delicious. Then one day a doubter decides to see for himself and performs the experiment on him. As the ethnologist is devoured piece by piece, he hopes, for he will never know who was right, that at least he is delicious, which will justify the ritual and his death. The other evening I had to believe the plan was true, because if it wasn't, then I had spent the past 2 years as the omnipotent architect of an evil dream. Better reality than a dream. If something is real, then it's real, and you're not to blame. Chapter 24. Sauve la fable Esha, des vertiges de Nahash, sauve la plaintive Eva, des mirages de la sensibilité, et que les cherubes me gardent. Joséphin Péladan, Comment on devient fée. Paris, Chamuel, 1893, page Roman 13. As I was advancing into the forest of resemblances, I received Belbo's letter. "Dear Kasabin, I didn't know until the other day that you were in Brazil. I lost touch completely, not even knowing that you had graduated. Congratulations. Anyway, someone at Pilades gave me your coordinates, and I thought it would be a good idea to bring you up to date on some developments in that unfortunate Colonel Ardenti business. It's been more than 2 years now, I know, and again I must apologize. I was the one who got you into trouble that morning, though I didn't mean to. I had almost forgotten the whole nasty story, but 2 weeks ago I was driving around in the Montefeltro area and happened upon the fortress of San Leo. In the 18th century, it seems, the region was under papal rule, and the Pope imprisoned Cagliostro there, in a cell with no real door. You entered it for the first and last time through a trapdoor in the ceiling, and with one little window from which the prisoner could see only the two churches of the village. I saw a bunch of roses on the shelf where Cagliostro had slept and died, and I was told that many devotees still make the pilgrimage to the place of his martyrdom. Among the most assiduous pilgrims are the members of Picatrix, a group of Milanese students of the occult. It publishes a magazine entitled, with great imagination, Picatrix. You know how curious I am about these oddities. So back in Milan I got hold of a copy of Picatrix, from which I learned that an evocation of the spirit of Cagliostro was to be held in a few days. I went. The walls were draped with banners covered with Kabbalistic signs, an abundance of owls of all kinds, scarabs and ibises, and oriental divinities of uncertain origin. Near the rear wall was a dais, a proscenium of burning torches held up by rough logs, and in the background an altar with a triangular altarpiece and statuettes of Isis and Osiris. The room was ringed by an amphitheater of figures of Anubis, and there was a portrait of Cagliostro, it could hardly have been of anyone else, could it, a gilded mummy in Cheops format, 2 5-armed candelabra, a gong suspended from 2 rampant snakes, on a podium a lectern covered by calico printed with hieroglyphics, and 2 crowns, 2 tripods, a little portable sarcophagus, a throne, a fake 17th-century fauteuil, 4 unmatched chairs suitable for a banquet with the Sheriff of Nottingham, and candles, tapers, votive lights, all flickering very spiritually. Anyway, to go on with the story. 7 altar boys entered in red cassocks and carrying torches, followed by the celebrant, apparently the head of Picatrix. He rejoiced in the commonplace name of Brambilla, in pink and olive vestments. He was, in turn, followed by the neophyte, or medium, and 6 acolytes in white, who all looked like Bing Crosby, but with infulas, the gods, if you recall our poets. Brambilla put on a triple crown with a half-moon, picked up a ritual sword, drew magic symbols on the dais, and summoned various angelic spirits with names ending in L. At this point I was vaguely reminded of those pseudo-Semitic incantations in Ingolf's message, but only for a moment, because I was immediately distracted by something unusual. The microphones on the dais were connected to a tuner that was supposed to pick up random waves in space, but the operator must have made a mistake, because first we heard a burst of disco music, and then Radio Moscow came on. Brambilla opened the sarcophagus, took out a book of magic spells, swung a thurible, and cried, "O Lord, thy kingdom come!" This seemed to achieve something, because Radio Moscow fell silent, but then, at the most magical moment, it came on again, with a drunken Cossack song, the kind they danced to with their behinds scraping the ground. Brambilla invoked the Clavicula Salomonis, risked self-immolation by burning a parchment on a tripod, summoned several divinities of the Temple of Karnak, testily asked to be placed on the cubic stone of Yesod, and insistently called out for Familiar 39, who must have been familiar enough to the audience, since a shiver ran through the hall. One woman sank into a trance, her eyes rolling back until only the whites were visible. People called for a doctor, but Brambilla invoked the power of the pentacles, and the neophyte, who had meanwhile sat down on the fake fauteuil, began to writhe and groan. Brambilla hovered over her, anxiously asking questions of her, or rather of Familiar 39, who, I suddenly realized, was Cagliostro himself. And now came the disturbing part, because the pathetic girl seemed to be in real pain. She trembled, sweated, bellowed, and began to speak in broken phrases of a temple and a door that must be opened. She said a vortex of power was being created, and we had to ascend to the Great Pyramid. Brambilla, up on the dais, became agitated. He banged the gong and called Isis in a loud voice. I was enjoying the performance until I heard the girl, still sighing and moaning, say something about 6 seals, a 120-year wait, and 36 invisibles. Now, there could be no doubt. She was talking about the message of Provins. I waited to hear more, but the girl slumped back, exhausted. Brambilla stroked her brow, blessed the audience with his thurible, and proclaimed the rite over. I was slightly awed, and also eager to understand. I tried to move closer to the girl, who in the meantime had come to her senses, slipped into a scruffy overcoat, and was on her way out through the rear exit. I was about to touch her on the shoulder when I felt someone grasp my arm. I turned, and it was Inspector De Angelis, who told me to let her go. He knew where to find her. He invited me out for coffee. I went, as if he had caught me doing something wrong, which, in a sense, he had. At the café he asked me what I was doing there, and why I had tried to approach the girl. This irritated me. We aren't living in a dictatorship, I said. I can approach anyone I choose. He apologized and explained that, although the Ardenti investigation had no priority, they had tried to reconstruct the 2 days he had spent in Milan before his meeting at Garamond and with the mysterious Rakowski. A year after Ardenti's disappearance, the police had found out by sheer luck that someone had seen him leaving the Picatrix offices in the company of the psychic girl, who incidentally was of interest to De Angelis because she lived with an individual not unknown to the narcotics squad. I told him I was there by chance, and I had been struck by the fact that the girl had spoken a phrase about six seals, which I had heard from the colonel. He remarked how strange it was that I could remember so clearly what the colonel said 2 years ago, yet at the time I had spoken only of some vague talk about the treasure of the Templars. I replied that the colonel had indeed said that the treasure was protected by six seals of some kind, but I hadn't considered this an important detail, because all treasures are protected by seals, usually seven, and by gold bugs. He observed that if all treasures were protected by gold bugs, he couldn't see why I should have been struck by what the girl had said. I asked him to stop treating me like a suspect, and he laughed and changed his tone. He said he didn't find it strange that the girl had said what she did, because Ardenti must have talked to her about his fantasies, perhaps trying to use her to establish some astral contact, as they say in those circles. A psychic, he went on, was like a sponge, a photographic plate with an unconscious that must look like an amusement park. The Picatrix bunch probably give her a brainwashing all year round, so it was not unlikely that once in a trance, because the girl was in earnest, wasn't faking, and there was something wrong with her head, she would see images that had been impressed on her long ago. But 2 days later, De Angelis stopped in at the office to say that, curiously enough, when he went to see the girl the day after the ceremony, she was gone. The neighbors said nobody had seen her since the afternoon before the evening of the ceremony. His suspicions were aroused, so he entered the apartment and found it torn to pieces. Sheets on the floor, pillows in one corner, trampled newspapers, empty drawers. No sign of her, or of her boyfriend, or roommate, or whatever you wanted to call him. He told me that if I knew anything more, I'd be wise to talk, because it was strange how the girl had disappeared into thin air, and he could think of only two reasons. Either somebody realized that De Angelis had her under surveillance, or it was noticed that one Jacopo Belbo had tried to talk to her. The things she had said in the trance might therefore have concerned something serious, some unfinished business. They, whoever they were, hadn't realized she knew so much. "Now suppose some colleague of mine gets it into his head that you killed her," De Angelis added with a beautiful smile. "You can see we have every interest in working together." I almost lost my temper, and God knows I don't do that often. I asked him why a person who's not home is assumed to have been murdered, and he asked if I remembered what happened to the colonel. Then I told him that if she had been killed or kidnapped, it must have happened that evening, when I was with him. He asked how I could be so sure of that, since we had said goodbye around midnight, and he had no way of knowing what had happened after that. I asked him if he was serious, and he said, what, hadn't I ever read a detective story? Didn't I know that the prime suspect was always the one who didn't have an alibi as radiant as Hiroshima? He said he would donate his head to an organ bank if I had an alibi for the time between 1 a.m. and the next morning. "What can I say, Kasabin? Maybe I should have told him the truth, but where I come from, men are stubborn and never back down. I am writing you because if I found your address, then De Angelis can find it too. If he gets in touch with you, at least you know the line I've taken. But since it doesn't seem a very straight line to me, go ahead and tell him everything if you want to. I'm embarrassed, I apologize. I feel like some kind of accomplice. Try as I might, I can't seem to find any noble justification for myself. Must be my peasant origins. In our part of the country, we're a mean bunch. The whole thing is, as the Germans say, unheimlich. Yours, Jacopo Belbo." Chapter 25. Of these mysterious initiates, now become numerous, bold, conspiring, all was born. Jesuitism, magnetism, Martinism, philosopher's stone, somnambulism, eclecticism. C.L. Cadet-Gassicourt, Le Tombeau de Jacques de Molay, Paris, Dizaine, 1797, page 91. The letter upset me. Not that I was afraid of being tracked down by De Angelis. We were in different hemispheres, after all, but for less definable reasons. At the time, I thought I was upset because a world I had left behind had bounced back at me, but today I realized that what bothered me was yet another strand of resemblance, the suspicion of an analogy. I was annoyed, too, at having to deal with Belbo again, Belbo and his eternal guilty conscience. I decided not to mention the letter to Amparo. A reassuring second letter arrived from Belbo 2 days later. The story of the psychic had had a reasonable ending. A police informer reported that the girl's lover had been involved in a settling of scores over a drug shipment, which he had sold retail instead of delivering it to the honest wholesaler who had already paid. They frown on that sort of behavior in those circles, and he vanished to save his neck. Obviously, he took the woman with him. Rummaging, then, among the newspapers left in their apartment, De Angelis found some magazines on the order of Picatrix, with a series of articles heavily underlined in red. One was about the treasure of the Templars, another about Rosicrucians who lived in a castle, cave, or some damn place where Post Centum Viginti Annos Patebo was written, and they called themselves the 36 Invisibles. So for De Angelis it was all clear. The psychic, consuming the same sort of literature that the colonel had, regurgitated it when she was in a trance. The matter was closed, passed on to the narcotics squad. Belbo's letter exuded relief. De Angelis' explanation seemed the most economical. The other evening in the periscope, I told myself that the facts might have been quite different. Granted, the psychic quoted something she had heard from Ardenti, but it was something her magazines never mentioned, something no one was supposed to know. Whoever had got rid of the colonel was in the Picatrix group, and this someone noticed that Belbo was about to question the psychic, so he eliminated her. To throw the investigators off the track, he also eliminated her lover, then instructed a police informer to say that the couple had fled. Simple enough, if there was really a plan. But how could there have been, since we invented the plan ourselves? And only much later was it possible for reality not only to catch up with fiction, but actually to precede it, or rather to rush ahead of it and repair the damage that it would cause. At the time, though, in Brazil, these were not my thoughts on receiving Belbo's second letter. Instead, I felt once more that something was resembling something else. I had been thinking about my trip to Bahia, and had spent an afternoon visiting bookstores and shops that sold cult objects, places I had ignored till then. I went to out-of-the-way little emporiums crammed with statues and idols. I purchased perfumadors of Yemenha, pungently scented mystical smoke sticks, incense, Swedish spray cans labeled Sacred Heart of Jesus, cheap amulets. I also found many books, some for devotees, others for people studying devotees, a mixture of exorcism manuals like Como Adivinar a Futuro na Bola de Cristal, and anthropology textbooks, and a monograph on the Rosicrucians. Suddenly it all seemed to come together. Satanic and Moorish rites in the Temple of Jerusalem, African witchcraft for the sub-proletarians of the Brazilian Northeast, the message of Provins with its 120 years, and the 120 years of the Rosicrucians. I felt like a walking blender mixing strange concoctions of different liquors. Or maybe I had caused some kind of short circuit, tripping over a vari-colored tangle of wires that had been entwining themselves for a long, long time. I bought the book on the Rosicrucians, thinking that if I spent a few hours in these bookstores, I would meet at least a dozen Colonel Ardentis and brainwashed psychics. I went home and officially informed Amparo that the world was full of unnatural characters. She promised me solace, and we ended the day naturally. That was late 1975. I decided to put resemblances aside and concentrate on my work. After all, I was supposed to be teaching Italian culture, not the Rosicrucians. I devoted myself to Renaissance philosophers, and I discovered that the men of secular modernity, once they had emerged from the darkness of the Middle Ages, had found nothing better to do than devote themselves to Kabbalah and magic. After 2 years spent with Neoplatonists who chanted formulas designed to convince nature to do things she had no intention of doing, I received news from Italy. After 2 years spent with Neoplatonists who chanted formulas designed to convince nature to do things she had no intention of doing, I received news from Italy. It seems my old classmates, or some of them at least, were now shooting people who didn't agree with them to convince the stubborn to do things they had no intention of doing. I couldn't understand it. now part of the Third World, I made up my mind to visit Bahia. I set off with a history of Renaissance culture and the book on the Rosicrucians, which had remained on a shelf, its pages uncut. Chapter 26. All the traditions of the earth must be seen as deriving from a fundamental mother tradition that, from the beginning, was entrusted to sinful man and to his first offspring. Louis-Claude de Saint-Martin, de l'Esprit des Choses, Paris, Laurent, 1800, Roman II, de l'Esprit des Traditions en Général. And I saw Salvador, Salvador da Bahia de Todos os Santos, the Black Rome, with 365 churches, which stand out against the line of hills or nestle along the bay, churches where the gods of the African pantheon are honored. Amparo knew a primitive artist who painted big wooden panels crammed with biblical and apocalyptic visions, dazzling as a medieval miniature, with Coptic and Byzantine elements. Naturally, he was a Marxist. He talked about the coming revolution, but he spent his days dreaming in the sacristies of the sanctuary of Nosso Senhor do Bonfim, a triumph of Oror Vacui, scaly with ex-votos that hung from the ceiling and encrusted the walls, a mystical assemblage of silver hearts, wooden arms and legs, images of wondrous rescues from glittering storms, waterspouts, maelstroms. He took us to the sacristy of another church, which was full of great furnishings redolent of jacaranda. "Who is that a painting of?" Amparo asked the sacristan. "Saint George?" The sacristan gave us a knowing look. "They call him Saint George," he said, "and if you don't call him that, the pastor gets angry. But he's Oxosi." For 2 days, the painter led us through naves and cloisters hidden behind decorated facades like silver plates now blackened and worn. Wrinkled, limping family accompanied us. The sacristies were sick with gold and pewter, heavy chests, precious frames. Along the walls, in crystal cases, life-size images of saints towered, dripping blood, their open wounds spattered with ruby droplets. Christs writhed in pain, their legs red. In a glow of late Baroque gold, I saw angels with Etruscan faces, Romanesque griffins, and Oriental sirens peeping out from the capitals. I moved along ancient streets, enchanted by names that sounded like songs. Rua da Agonia, Avenida dos Amores, Travesa de Chico Diabo. Our visit to Salvador took place during a period when the local government, or someone acting in its name, was trying to renew the old city and was closing down the thousands of brothels. But the project was only at midpoint. At the feet of those deserted and leprous churches, embarrassed by their own evil-smelling alleys, 15-year-old black prostitutes still swarmed, ancient women selling African sweets crouched along the sidewalks with their steaming pots, and hordes of pimps danced amid trickles of sewage to the sound of transistor radios in nearby bars. The ancient palaces of the Portuguese settlers, surmounted by coats of arms now illegible, had become houses of ill repute. On the third day, our guide took us to the bar of a hotel in a renovated part of the upper city, on a street full of luxury antique shops. He was to meet an Italian gentleman, he told us, who wanted to buy, and for the asking price, a painting of his, 3 meters by 2, in which teeming angelic hosts waged the final battle against the opposing legions. And so we met Signor Allier. Impeccably dressed in a double-breasted pinstriped suit despite the heat, he wore gold-rimmed eyeglasses and had a rosy complexion, silver hair. He kissed Amparo's hand as if he knew of no other way to greet a lady, and he ordered champagne. When the painter had to leave, Allier handed him a pack of traveler's checks and said to send the picture to his hotel. We stayed on to chat. Allier spoke Portuguese correctly, but it sounded as if he had learned it in Lisbon. This accent made him seem even more like a gentleman of bygone days. He asked about us, commented on the possible Genevan origin of my name, and expressed curiosity about Amparo's family history, though somehow he had already guessed that the main branch was from Recife. About his own origins, he was vague. "I'm like many people here," he said. "Countless races are represented in my genes. The name is Italian, from the ancient estate of an ancestor. Perhaps a nobleman, but who cares these days? It was curiosity that brought me to Brazil. All forms of tradition fascinate me." He told us he had a fine library of religious sciences in Milan, where he had been living for some years. Come and see me when you get back. I have a number of interesting things, from Afro-Brazilian rites to the Isis cults of the late Roman Empire.
I adore the Isis cults, Amparo said, who often, out of pride, pretended to be silly. You must know everything there is to know about them.
Allier replied modestly, only what little I've seen of them.
Amparo tried again. But wasn't it 2,000 years ago?
I'm not as young as you are, Allier smiled.
Like Cagliostro, I joked. Wasn't he the one who was heard to murmur to his attendant as they passed a crucifix, I told that Jew to be careful that evening, but he just wouldn't listen?
Allier stiffened. Afraid I had offended him, I started to apologize, but our host stopped me with an indulgent smile.
Cagliostro was a humbug. It's common knowledge when and where he was born, and he didn't even manage to live very long. A braggart.
I don't doubt it.
Cagliostro was a humbug, Allier repeated, but that does not mean that there have not been, and still are, privileged persons who have lived many lives. Modern science knows so little about the aging process. It's quite possible that mortality is simply the result of poor education. Cagliostro was a humbug, but the Comte de Saint-Germain was not. He may not have been boasting when he claimed to have learned some of his chemical secrets from the ancient Egyptians. Nobody believed him, so out of politeness to his listeners, he pretended to be joking.
And now you pretend to be joking in order to convince us you're telling the truth, Amparo said.
You are not only beautiful, but extraordinarily perceptive, too, Allier said. But I beseech you, do not believe me. Were I to appear before you in the dusty splendor of my many centuries, your own beauty would wither, and I could never forgive myself.
Amparo was conquered, and I felt a twinge of jealousy. I changed the subject to churches and to the St. George Uxossi we had seen.
Allier said we absolutely had to attend a condomblé.
Not one where they charge admission. They let you into the real ones without asking anything of you. You don't even have to be a believer. You must observe respectfully, of course, showing the same tolerance of all faiths as they do in accepting your unbelief. At first sight, a Pai or Mai de Santo might seem to be straight out of Uncle Tom's cabin, but they have as much culture as a Vatican theologian.
Amparo put her hand on his.
Take us, she said. I went to one many years ago, in a tenda de Umbanda, but I can't recall much about it. All I remember is great turmoil.
The physical contact embarrassed Allier, but he didn't take his hand away.
He did something I later saw him do in moments of reflection. Reaching into his vest with his other hand, he took out a little gold and silver box with an agate on the lid. It looked like a snuff box or a pill box. There was a small wax light burning on the table, and Allier, as if by chance, held the box near it. When exposed to heat, the agate's color could no longer be discerned, and in its place appeared a miniature, very fine, in green, blue, and gold, depicting a shepherdess with a basket of flowers. He turned it in his fingers with absent-minded devotion, as if telling a rosary. When he noticed my interest, he smiled and put the object away.
Turmoil? I hope, my sweet lady, that, although you are so perceptive, you are not excessively sensitive. An exquisite quality, of course, when it accompanies grace and intelligence, but dangerous if you go to certain places without knowing what to look for or what you will find. Moreover, the Umbanda must not be confused with the Condomblé. The latter is completely indigenous, Afro-Brazilian, as they say, whereas the former is a much later development born of a fusion of native rites and esoteric European culture, and with a mystique I would call Templar.
The Templars had found me again. I told Allier I had studied them. He regarded me with interest.
A most curious circumstance, my young friend, to find a young Templar here under the Southern Cross.
I wouldn't want you to consider me an adept.
Please, Signor Casaubon, if you knew how much nonsense there is in this field.
I do know.
Good. But we'll see one another soon.
In fact, we arranged to meet the next day. All of us wanted to explore the little covered market along the port. We met there the next morning, and it was a fish market, an Arab souk, a saint's day fair that had proliferated with cancerous virulence, like a lord overrun by forces of evil, wizard rainmakers side by side with ecstatic and stigmatized capuchins. There were little propitiatory sacks with prayers sewn into the lining, little hands in semi-precious stones, the middle finger extended, coral horns, crucifixes, stars of David, sexual symbols of pre-Judaic religions, hammocks, rugs, purses, sphinxes, sacred hearts, Bororo quivers, shell necklaces. The degenerate mystique of the European conquistadors was owed to the occult knowledge of the slaves, just as the skin of every passerby told a similar story of lost genealogies. "This," Allier said, "is the very image of what the ethnology textbooks call Brazilian syncretism. An ugly word in the official view, but in its loftiest sense, syncretism is the acknowledgement that a single tradition runs through and nurtures all religion, all learning, all philosophy. The wise man does not discriminate. He gathers together all the shreds of light, from wherever they may come. These slaves, or descendants of slaves, are therefore wiser than the ethnologists of the Sorbonne. At least you understand me, do you not, lovely lady?" "In my mind, no," Amparo said. "But in my womb, yes. Sorry, I don't imagine the Comte de Saint-Germain ever expressed himself in such terms. What I mean is, I was born in this country, and even things I don't understand somehow speak to me from somewhere. Here, I believe." And she touched her breast. "What was it Cardinal Lambertini once said to a lady wearing a splendid diamond cross on her décolletage? What joy it would be to die on that Calvary. Well, how I would love to listen to those voices. But now it is I who must beg your forgiveness, both of you. I am from an age when one would have accepted damnation to pay homage to beauty. You two must want to be alone. Let's keep in touch." "He's old enough to be your father," I said to Amparo as I dragged her through the stalls. "Even my great-great-grandfather. He implied that he's at least 1,000 years old. Are you jealous of a pharaoh's mummy?" "I'm jealous of anyone who makes a light bulb flash on in your head." "How wonderful. That's love." Chapter 27. One day, saying that he had known Pontius Pilate in Jerusalem, he described minutely the governor's house and listed the dishes served at supper. Cardinal de Rohan, believing these were fantasies, turned to the Comte de Saint-Germain's valet, an old man with white hair and an honest expression. "My friend," he said to the servant, "I find it hard to believe what your master is telling us. Granted that he may be a ventriloquist, and even that he can make gold, but that he is 2,000 years old and saw Pontius Pilate, that is too much. Were you there?" "Oh no, Monsignore," the valet answered ingenuously. "I have been in Monsieur le Comte's service only 400 years. Colin de Plancy, Dictionnaire Infernal, Paris, Millier, 1844, page 434. In the days that followed, Salvador absorbed me completely. I spent little time in the hotel. But as I was leafing through the index of the book on the Rosicrucians, I came across a reference to the Comte de Saint-Germain. "Well, well," I said to myself, "tout se tient." Voltaire wrote of him, "C'est un homme qui ne meurt jamais et qui sait tout." But Frederick the Great wrote back, "C'est un comte pour rire." Horace Walpole described him as an Italian or Spaniard or Pole who had made a fortune in Mexico and then fled to Constantinople with his wife's jewels. The most reliable information about him comes from the memoirs of Madame d'Ossay, La Pompadour's femme de chambre. Some authority, the intolerant Amparo said. He had gone by various names, Surmont in Brussels, Well Done in Leipzig, the Marquis of Aymar or Bedmar or Belmar, Count Soltikoff. In 1745, he was arrested in London, where he excelled as a musician, giving violin and harpsichord recitals in drawing rooms. 3 years later, he offered his services as an expert in dyeing to Louis XV in Paris in exchange for a residence in the Chateau of Chambord. The king sent him on diplomatic missions to Holland, where he got into some sort of trouble and fled to London again. In 1762, he turned up in Russia, then again in Belgium, where he encountered Casanova, who tells us how the Count turned a coin into gold. In 1776, he appeared at the court of Frederick the Great, to whom he proposed various projects having to do with chemistry. 8 years later, he died in Schleswig, at the court of the Landgrave of Hesse, where he was putting the finishing touches on a manufactory for paints. Nothing exceptional, the typical career of an 18th-century adventurer. Not as many loves as Casanova, and frauds less theatrical than Cagliostro's. Apart from the odd incident here and there, he enjoyed some credibility with those in authority,
to whom he promised the wonders of alchemy, though with an industrial slant. The only unusual feature was the rumor of his immortality, which he undoubtedly instigated himself. In drawing rooms he would casually mention remote events as if he had been an eyewitness, and he cultivated his legend gracefully, en sourdine. The book also quoted a passage from Giovanni Papini's Gog, describing a nighttime encounter with the Comte de Saint-Germain on the deck of an ocean liner. The Count, oppressed by his millennial past and by the memories crowding his brain, spoke in despairing tones reminiscent of Funes, El Memorioso of Borges, except that Papini's story dates from 1930. "You must not imagine our lot is deserving of envy," the Count says to Gog. "After a couple of centuries, an incurable ennui takes possession of the wretched immortals. The world is monotonous, men learn nothing, and with every generation they fall into the same errors and nightmares. Events are not repeated, but they resemble one another. Novelties end, surprises, revelations. I can confess to you now that only the Red Sea is listening to us. My immortality bores me. Earth holds no more secrets for me, and I have no hope any more in my fellows." "Curious character," I remarked. "Obviously our friend Allier is playing at impersonating him. A gentleman getting on in years, a bit dotty, with money to spend, free time for travel, and an interest in the supernatural." "A consistent reactionary with the courage to be decadent," Amparo said. "Actually, I prefer him to bourgeois Democrats." "Sisterhood is powerful, but let a man kiss your hand and you're ecstatic. That's how you've trained us for centuries. Let us free ourselves gradually. I didn't say I wanted to marry him."
"That's good."
The following week, Allier telephoned me. That evening, he said, we would be allowed to visit a torero de Candomblé. We wouldn't be admitted to the actual rite, because the Alarixa was suspicious of tourists, but she would welcome us herself and would show us around before it started. He picked us up by car and drove through the favelas beyond the hill. The building where we stopped had a humble look, like a big garage, but on the threshold an old black man met us and purified us with a fumigant. Up ahead was a bare little garden with an immense corbeille of palm fronds, on which some tribal delicacies, the comidas de santo, were laid out. Inside we found a large hall, the walls covered with paintings, especially ex-votos, and African masks. Allier explained the arrangement of furniture. The benches in the rear were for the uninitiated, the little dais for the instruments, and the chairs for the oga. "They are people of some standing, not necessarily believers, but respectful of the cult. Here in Bahia, the great Jorge Amado is an oga in one terrero. He was selected by Yansa, mistress of war and winds." "But where do these divinities come from?" I asked. "It's complicated. First of all, there's a Sudanese branch, dominant here in the north from the early days of slavery. The Condomblé of the Orixash, in other words the African divinities, come from this branch. In the southern states you find the influence of the Bantu groups, and this is where all the intermingling starts. The northern cults remain faithful to the original African religions, but in the south the primitive Makumba develops toward the Umbanda, which is influenced by Catholicism, Cardicism, and European occultism."
"So, no Templars tonight?"
That was meant to be a metaphor, but no, no Templars tonight. "Syncretism, however, is a very subtle process. Did you notice, outside, near the Comidas de Santo, a little iron statue, a sort of devil with a pitchfork, and with votive offerings at his feet? That's Exu, very powerful in the Umbanda, but not in the Candomblé. Still, the Candomblé also honors him as a kind of degenerate Mercury. In the Umbanda, they are possessed by Exu, but not here. However, he's treated affectionately, but you never can tell. You see that wall over there?" He was pointing at the polychrome statues of a naked Indio and an old black slave, seated, dressed in white, and smoking a pipe. "They are a Caboclo and a Preto Velo, spirits of the departed. Very important in Umbanda rites. What are they doing here? Receiving homage. They are not used, because the Candomblé entertains relations only with the African Orixash, but they are not cast out on that account." "What do all these churches have in common, then?" "Well, during the rite, in all Afro-Brazilian cults, the initiates go into a trance and are possessed by higher beings. In the Candomblé, these beings are the Orixash, In the Umbanda they are spirits of the departed.
I forgot my own country and my own race, Amparo said. My God, a bit of Europe and a bit of historical materialism, and I forgot everything, the stories I used to hear from my grandmother.
Historical materialism? Arye smiled.
Oh yes, I believe I've heard of it. An apocalyptic cult that came out of the Trier region, am I right?
I squeezed Amparo's arm.
No Pazaran, darling.
God, she murmured.
Alie watched our brief whispered dialogue in silence.
Infinite are the powers of syncretism, my dear. Shall I tell you a political version of this whole story? Legally, the slaves were freed in the 19th century, but all the archives of the slave trade were burned in an effort to wipe out the stigmata of slavery. Formally, slaves were free, but their past was gone. In the absence of any family identity, they tried to reconstruct a collective past. It was their way of opposing what you young people call the establishment.
But you just said those European sects were also part of it.
My dear, purity is a luxury, and slaves take what they can get. But they have their revenge. By now they have captured more whites than you think. The original African cults possessed the weakness of all religions. They were local, ethnic, short-sighted. But when they met the myths of the conquerors, they reproduced an ancient miracle, breathing new life into the mystery cults that arose around the Mediterranean during the 2nd and 3rd centuries of our era, when Rome in decline was exposed to ferment that had originated in Persia, Egypt, and pre-Judaic Palestine. In the centuries of the late empire, Africa received the influences of all the religions of the Mediterranean and condensed them into a package. Europe was corrupted by Christianity as a state religion, but Africa preserved the treasures of knowledge, just as it had preserved and spread them in the days of the Egyptians, passing them on to the Greeks, who wreaked such great havoc with them.
Chapter 28. There is a body that enfolds the whole of the world. Imagine it in the form of a circle, for this is the form of the whole. Imagine now that under the circle of this body are the 36 decans, midway between the total circle and the circle of the zodiac, separating these two circles, and, so to speak, delimiting the zodiac, transported along it with the planets. The changing of kings, the rising up of cities, famine, plague, the tides of the sea, earthquakes, none of these takes place without the influence of the decans. Corpus hermeticus, stabilis, exceptum sex.
What treasures of knowledge!
Do you realize how great the 2nd and 3rd centuries after Christ were? Not because of the pomp of the empire in its sunset, but because of what was burgeoning in the Mediterranean basin then. In Rome, the Praetorians were slaughtering their emperors, but in the Mediterranean area there flourished the epic of Apuleius, the mysteries of Isis, and that great return to spirituality, Neoplatonism, Gnosis. Blissful times, before the Christians seized power and began to put heretics to death. A splendid epoch in which dwelled the nous, a time dazzled by ecstasies and peopled with presences, emanations, demons, and angelic hosts. The knowledge I am talking about is diffuse and disjointed. It is as ancient as the world itself, reaching back beyond Pythagoras to the Brahmins of India, the Hebrews, the mages, the gymnosophists, and even the barbarians of the far north, the Druids of Gaul and the British Isles. The Greeks called the barbarians by that name because, to overeducated Greek ears, their languages sounded like barking, and the Greeks therefore assumed that they were unable to express themselves. In fact, the barbarians knew much more than the Hellenes at the time, precisely because their language was impenetrable. Do you believe the people who will dance tonight know the meaning of all the chants and magic names they will utter? Fortunately, they do not. And each unknown name will be a kind of breathing exercise, a mystical vocalization. The Age of the Antonines. The world was full of marvelous correspondences, subtle resemblances. The only way to penetrate them, and to be penetrated by them, was through dreams, oracles, magic, which allow us to act on nature and her forces, moving like with like. Knowledge is elusive and volatile. It escapes measurement. That's why the conquering god of that era was Hermes, inventor of all trickery, god of crossroads and thieves. He was also the creator of writing, which is the art of evasion and dissimulation, and a navigation that carries us to the end of all boundaries, where everything dissolves into the horizon, where cranes lift stones from the ground and weapons transform life into death, and water pumps make heavy matter float, and philosophy deludes and deceives. And do you know where Hermes is today? Right here. You passed him when you came through the door. They call him Exu, messenger of the gods, go-between, traitor, who is ignorant of the difference between good and evil. He looked at us with amused distrust. You believe that I am as hasty in distributing gods as Hermes is in distributing merchandise. But look at this book which I bought this morning in a little shop in Pellerino. Magic and Mystery of St. Cyprian, Recipes for Spells to Win Love or Cause Your Enemy's Death, Invocations to the Angels and to the Virgin. Popular literature for these mystics whose skin is black. But this is St. Cyprian of Antioch, about whom there is an immense literature dating from the Silver Age. His parents wanted him to learn all there was to know about the earth, land, sea, and air, so they sent him to the most distant realms, that he might acquire all mysteries, including the generation and corruption of herbs and the virtues of plants and of animals. The secrets not of natural history, but of occult science, those buried in the depths of distant and archaic traditions. At Delphi, Cyprian dedicated himself to Apollo and to the dramaturgy of the serpent. He studied the mysteries of Mithra. On Mount Olympus, at 15, guided by 15 hierophants, he attended the rites that summon the prince of this world in order to master his intrigues. In Argos, he was initiated into the mysteries of Hera. In Phrygia, he learned hepatoscopic fortune-telling. At last there was nothing left of land, sea, or air that he did not know. No ghost, no object, no artifice of any kind. Not even the art of altering writing through sorcery. In the underground temples of Memphis, he had learned how demons communicate with earthly things and places, what they loathe and love, how they dwell in darkness and how they mount resistance in certain domains, how they are able to possess souls and bodies, the feats of higher knowledge they can perform, of memory, terror, and illusion, and the art of causing turmoil in the earth, influencing underground currents. Then, alas, he was converted, but something of his knowledge remained and was passed on, and we find it here, in the mouths and minds of these ragged people you call idolaters. My lovely friend, a little while ago you looked at me as if I were a ci-devant, who among us is living in the past. You, who would bestow the horrors of the toiling industrial age upon this country, or I, who wish that our poor Europe might recover the naturalness and faith of these children of slaves. Jesus, Amparo said in a nasty hiss, you know as well as I do that it's just another way of keeping them quiet. Not quiet, capable of expectation. Without a sense of expectation there can be no paradise. Isn't that what you Europeans have taught us? I'm a European? The important thing is not skin color, but faith in tradition. Granted, these children of slaves pay a price in returning a sense of expectation to a West paralyzed by well-being. Perhaps they even suffer, but still they know the language of the spirits of nature, of the air, the waters, and the winds. You people are exploiting us again. Again? Yes. You should have learned your lesson in 89, Count. We get fed up, and then? Smiling like an angel, she drew her beautiful hand straight across her throat. For me, even Amparo's teeth aroused desire. How dramatic, Allier said, taking his snuff-box from his pocket and stroking it with his fingers. So you recognized me. But it wasn't the slaves who made heads roll in 89. It was the upstanding bourgeoisie whom you should hate. Besides, the Comte de Saint-Germain has seen many a head roll in all his centuries and many a head reattached. But wait, here comes the Mai de Santo. The Yalariksa. Our meeting with the abbess of the Terrero was calm, cordial, civilized, and rich in folklore. She was a big black woman with a dazzling smile. At first you would have said she was a housewife, but when we began talking I understood how women like this could rule the cultural life of Salvador. Are the Oriksash people or forces? I asked her. The Mai de Santo answered that they were forces, obviously. Water, wind, leaves, rainbows. But how did she prevent ordinary people from seeing them as warriors, women, saints of the Catholic Church? Do you yourselves not also worship a cosmic force in the form of virgins? She replied. The important thing is to venerate the force. The aspect of the force must fit each man's ability to comprehend. She invited us to visit the chapels in the garden before the rite began.
In the garden were the houses of the Orixash. A swarm of black girls in Bahian dress was cheerfully gathered there, making the final preparations. The houses of the Orixash were arranged around the garden like the chapels of a sacred mount. Outside each one was displayed the image of the corresponding saint. Inside, the garish colors of flowers clashed with those of the statues and the just-cooked foods offered to the gods. White for Uxala, blue and pink for Yemanya, red and white for Zango, yellow and gold for Ogun. Initiates kneeled and kissed the threshold, touching themselves on the forehead and behind the ear. "But is Yemanya Our Lady of the Conception or not?" I asked. "Is Zango St. Jerome or not?" "Don't ask embarrassing questions," Allier advised. "It's even more complicated in an Umbanda. St. Anthony and Saints Cosmas and Damien are part of the Oxalá line. Sirens, water nymphs, caboclas of the sea and the rivers, sailors and guiding stars are part of the Yemanya line. The line of the Orient includes Hindus, doctors, scientists, Arabs and Moroccans, Japanese, Chinese, Mongols, Egyptians, Aztecs, Incas, Caribs, and Romans. To the Oxosi line belong the sun, the moon, the caboclo of waterfalls, and the caboclo of the blacks. In the Ogun line we come upon Ogun, Beramar, Rompemato, Yara, Mege, Narowe. In other words, it all depends."
"Jesus," Amparo said again.
"Oxalá, you mean," I murmured to her, my lips brushing her ear.
"Calm down, no pasarán."
The Aluriksa showed us a series of masks that some acolytes were bringing into the temple. These were big straw dominoes or hoods which the mediums would put on as they went into a trance, falling prey to the divinity. This was a form of modesty, she explained. In some tereros, the chosen danced with their faces bare, letting onlookers see their passion. But the initiates should be shielded, respected, removed from the curiosity of the profane or anyone who cannot understand the inner jubilation and grace. That was the custom in this terero, she said, and that was why outsiders were not readily admitted. Maybe someday, she remarked, who knows, we might well meet again. But she didn't want us to leave without sampling some of the comidas de santo, not from the corbeilles, which had to remain intact until the end of the rite, but from her own kitchen. She took us to the back of the terrero, where there was a multicolored banquet of manioc, pimento, cocoa, amandoim, gingibre, moqueca de sirimole, batapa, efo, caruru, black beans with farofa, amid a languid odor of African spices, sweet and strong tropical flavors, which we tasted dutifully, knowing that we were sharing the food of the ancient Sudanese gods. And rightly so, the Aluriksa told us, because each of us, whether he knew it or not, was the child of an Oriksa. And often it was possible to tell which one. I boldly asked whose son I was. The Aluriksa demurred at first, saying she couldn't be sure, but then she agreed to examine the palm of my hand. She looked into my eyes and said, "You are a son of Oxalá." I was proud. Amparo, now relaxed, suggested we find out whose son Allier was, but he said he preferred not to know. When we were home again, Amparo said to me, "Did you see his hand? Instead of the lifeline, he has a series of broken lines, like a stream that comes to a stone, parts, and flows together again a meter farther on. The line of a man who must have died many times."
World champion of the metempsychosis relay.
"No pasarán," Amparo said, laughing.